Welcome to the Science Podcast for April 20th, 2012. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, synthetic DNA, the role of confidence in group decision-making, and a citrus crisis in the U.S., plus a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
The special properties of DNA, its contributions to inheritance and evolution, may not be that unique after all. Philip Holliger and colleagues stored genetic information in six synthetic polymers, or so-called XNAs, then used enzymes to transcribe that information into DNA, and finally back into XNA. I spoke with Holliger from his office in the UK about the implications of this synthetic genetic system.
We've been able to show that both heredity, that is, if you want, information storage and propagation, and evolution, which are really two hallmarks of life, can be reproduced, they can be implemented in alternative polymers other than DNA and RNA. There is nothing, you know, Goldilocks about DNA and RNA. There is no overwhelming functional imperative for genetic systems or biology to be based on these two nucleic acids, but they could be implemented, at least in principle, using alternative polymers.
So you were looking for substitutes for the normal components of the genetic system that we have.
Yeah.
What were the key elements that you focused on reproducing?
There's a lot of chemistry that seeks to build alternative nucleic acids, and people have been modifying the bases, the sugars and the backbone. But what we were focusing on is the type of nucleic acids or polymers, if you want, that would retain the ability to communicate with the natural nucleic acids, DNA and RNA. So we retain Watson-Crick base pairing, and we retain the ability to form double helices both with DNA and RNA. And that's how we chose our starting components for these experiments.
You wanted to make sure that you could still communicate back with the quote-unquote natural system.
Exactly, yeah.
So what are some of the problems with the current system that we have, DNA, RNA, and its associated enzymes, when we try to use them as molecular biology tools?
There isn't really absolutely nothing wrong with DNA and RNA as far as we use them to study biology. But I think there is increasing interest in using DNA mostly, but also RNA, not just to read genetic information, but, you know, to build, for example, nanotechnology objects and devices, and to evolve them into three-dimensional shapes, they're called aptamers, that are able to bind to molecular targets with really similar affinity and specificity as antibodies can.
So you want to take advantage of base pairing, but maybe alter the structure of the polymer?
What we've done is, by altering the chemistry of the backbone, we're both altering the structure and really the whole physicochemical properties of the resulting polymers and obviously the three-dimensional structures they fold into.
Mm-hmm.
So to give you an example, one of the alternative polymers, which we call XNAs, that we've been working with and that we've been able to evolve into specific aptamers that bind to a protein and an RNA in a highly specific way, they're completely impervious to the degradation enzymes which destroy DNA and RNA in the body. So they cannot be degraded by these enzymes. And they're also chemically much more stable, unlike DNA, for example, which degrades very rapidly at acid pH. Those polymers are entirely stable. And indeed, the aptamers that we've made retain their fold even at pH 1. So while DNA would be rapidly degraded under these conditions.
Hmm.
So I think that gives you a glimpse of what we can do already. And really, our goals for the future, you know, would be to work towards increasingly more divergent chemistry to be able to really tailor-made properties, you know, for the type of applications we're envisaging with these XNA polymers and aptamers.
So can you tell us a little bit more about the synthetic genetic system that you came up with? What are some of the other differences between it and a DNA-based system?
Well, I mean, as I said, it retains the same Watson-Crick base pairing. So what we can do and what we describe, we have polymerases that can synthesize the XNAs from a DNA template.
Mm-hmm.
And we have another class of polymerases which can then use the XNA as a template to reconvert that sequence information into DNA, and that really closes the loop, the replication loop. So we can replicate these XNAs via a DNA intermediate, a little bit like a retroviral replication.
So you can move things from DNA to XNA and then back to DNA using these special enzymes?
Yes, exactly. So the genetic information can be moved from DNA into XNA and back into DNA, and that completes the replication cycle.
So taking things a step further, you also look to see if this synthetic system could evolve. Can you describe how you set that up?
Going back to the replication cycle, this now allows you very easily to start with a set of random sequences. You can order a random set of DNA sequences from a commercial supplier, and we then convert this into a vast library of random XNA sequences, and we fold them up into three-dimensional shapes, and then we expose them to a target that we have attached to a solid support, and the three-dimensional shapes that can bind to that solid support will be retained, and the others, the non-binders, will be washed away, and the binders will be retained on the solid support, and can, after washing, we elute them, and we can convert them back into DNA, amplify them again, and go into another cycle of evolution. And through iterative cycles of this, we can stepwise evolve aptamers, binders made from entirely from XNA that very specifically will bind that given target antigen, and with high affinity.
So you have an enzyme that can convert between DNA and XNA.
Yes, and another enzyme that can convert back from XNA to DNA.
But you don't have one that will amplify it the same way that that we have for DNA.
XNA on XNA. I mean, we're describing six different XNAs in the paper, and for one of them, we can do XNA on XNA.
Uh-huh.
But for the others, it's not very efficient. The truth is, for opportunistic reasons, it's actually desirable for us to go via DNA intermediate because it allows us to take advantage of standard cloning and sequencing technologies to analyze the sequences we've generated and isolated.
So kind of stepping back a bit, this is a pretty abstract paper, even by biochemistry standards. You're getting at what makes
things... I don't think so.
you're getting at things, at what makes things genetic or what can become a hereditary system. What are some practical results we can expect from determining the answers to these big picture questions?
The answer to that question, I think, has always fascinated me because it is such an amazing property of DNA and RNA to be able to store information. I mean, there's really nothing, no other molecules in chemistry which can do this to this level of extent. And obviously, there's the iconical double helical structure which immediately, you know, suggests how this works. So I think what I always hope we would be able to make a contribution to is to provide tools for a more systematic study of what is required in a molecule to be able to do that, to store information and propagate it. And from a more practical aspect, if you can store information and replicate it, evolution is almost an inevitable consequence of that. Yeah. And for every polymer we succeed, you know, you open up this sequence space that previously could not be explored. And within that sequence space, you know, there's obviously also a functional, a phenotypic space. So we'd be able to find, you know, entirely new structures and phenotypes that were previously not accessible. And that, I'm positive, that will have a wide range of biotechnological applications. I've talked a little bit about the aptamers that we've made already that are acid stable and can't be degraded. And I think there is a much wider range of desirable properties that we'll be able to dial in as the system progresses and we become able to do more and more divergent chemistry.
Okay, well, thanks so much.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Philip Holliger and colleagues write about synthetic genetic polymers in a report this week.
Two heads are better than one. The familiar adage is based on the principle that a group of people has a greater collective knowledge than any of the individuals alone. But how does each individual's confidence in that knowledge factor into the group's negotiations and ultimate decision? Asher Koryat observed the relationship between confidence and accuracy when groups of two people, or dyads, were given challenges of varying levels of difficulty. He spoke with me about his research and inspiration from Haifa, Israel.
What happened is that they saw the research by Bahrami and their associates. What they did was a very simple experiment in which they presented people with pairs of perceptual stimuli. They had to make a decision. The experiment was conducted in diets, so each of them had to make his or her own individual decision. Then they shared their decision and reached a joint decision. And the result was that the joint decision was better than that of each individual. In fact, better than that of the best individual. And the conclusion is that two heads are better than one.
Hmm.
That's the basic thing. And in fact, they found that social interaction was critical for the effect. So I tried to see whether I can achieve the same effect without any interaction between the individuals by taking into account their confidence in their decisions. So I simply ran the experiment all over again, exactly in the same way that Barami and his associates did, but participants performed the experiment individually. And then I simply paired the subjects to form a virtual diet. And for each virtual diet and for each stimulus, I simply picked the response that was associated with higher confidence. So that way I was able to compile all high confidence responses to generate something that I called a dummy high confidence participant.
Mm-hmm.
And that participant actually did much better than the best individual. So that's the basic result.
So basically, the impetus for your study was this other study on decision-making in dyads or in partners of groups of two people. And the main difference between your study and theirs, well, there are two main differences. One is that you took confidence into account more so than this other study, but also that in yours, you said that each partner was working individually. So they weren't actually communicating as a team. They each were submitting their own answers independently. Can you go into a little more detail about that?
Well, actually, if you think about it, group decisions are dominated by the most confident individuals. And in fact, that's what I was trying to simulate.
Hmm.
And if you trust the confidence of individuals, then you can take it into account without having to have social interaction between them. So in a sense, I'm sure that you are familiar with many attempts to aggregate information across individuals. For example, when people want to generate forecasts, economic forecasts, usually you take into account the opinions of different individuals and you average them, and sometimes you get some of the best forecasts that you can get. In this case, what I did was not to aggregate or average, but to select the best confidence responses
mm-hmm.
and generate a kind of aggregated judgment. And what I found is that this kind of selection actually produces better accuracy than aggregating the information across individuals, or even better than the best individual. So that's the general idea. In fact, it can be used anywhere. All you have to do is collect some confidence judgments, and you can do better than simply averaging the information across individuals.
Okay, so that's the overall finding. Let's delve into your methodology and results a little bit more.
Well, the first message that I gave is that you can achieve the same thing as Barami and his associates by simply taking into account confidence judgments. But the second thing was to qualify that conclusion. And here it's a little bit more complicated, because what happens is that confidence judgments do predict accuracy in most cases, but not in all cases. In fact, what I did in my own experiments was to show that confidence and accuracy are correlated positively as long as people's decisions are correct, which is true in many cases. I mean, when people are asked to make, for example, perceptual decisions, usually the correlation between confidence and accuracy is very high. People know when they are right. They know when they are wrong.
Hmm.
But there are many cases in which the group as a whole is in error. For example, there are perceptual illusions, there are memory illusions, there are cognitive biases. And the question that they ask is, what happens in those cases in which the group tends to be wrong? So I gathered a bunch of items for which people are likely to be wrong. And in that case, what you find is that two heads are actually worse than one. Because what happens if the group is wrong in the first place, relying on the high confident individuals actually exacerbates the situation, and you are now worse than you were in the first place. And in fact, in these cases, when you take what they called the consensually wrong items, the best thing to do is take the lead of the less confident individual.
Wow.
But that's not something that groups will do, I'm afraid.
Right.
And the fifth experiment attempted to show that they can get exactly the same results within person. For example, a person makes a choice twice. And then what you can do is simply choose the response that was associated with higher confidence for the same person. And again, you get exactly the same thing. So, in fact, there is a more general perspective for the analysis of these results, which goes beyond social interaction, because it occurs even within individuals.
How interesting. So basically what you're saying is that when you have a group of people in which you're dealing with something that might be more general or common knowledge, where people are more likely to know the right answer, then going with the most confident responders is in your favor. They're likely to be accurate. But when you're dealing with something that's trivia or something that's a little bit trickier, then in fact, the most confident members of the team are less likely to actually be right?
That's exactly right. But you see, it's not just trivia. I mean, if you think about economic forecasts,
mm-hmm.
I mean, how would you know whether the group as a whole is correct or not? If you knew it, you don't have to rely on joint decisions or anything.
Right.
What happens is that people follow their confidence blindly. They take it for granted that it's completely valid. When I am confident, I will follow my own decision. When I'm not confident, I will not follow it, regardless of the accuracy of my decision. That's a problem. And the same is true at the group level. We trust people who are more confident.
So what do you think are some of the lessons to be taken out of this? Is there anything that anybody can implement if they want to be making better decisions in their lives? Or is this too complicated to sort of be able to do that just yet?
I'm afraid it's a little bit too complicated, but take as an example economic decisions. There is an idea that if you want to invest in a certain share, what you have to do is try to think not about whether it's right or wrong to do so, but what other people will do, because that will determine the fate of that share. So the general idea, and they have some data that support it, is that if one person prefers to invest in one share, the other person prefers to invest in another share, which one should you take? Usually what happens is that the person who is more confident predicts better what other people will do. So it can be useful in some contexts when you have to predict what other people do.
Right.
It's not that useful as an index of accuracy.
But on the other hand, if I were going to, say, a trivia night with my friends, and there was a question that clearly we had no idea what the answer is, that in fact we should actually go with the least confident member of the team?
Yeah, you're right. But you have to know beforehand where you are standing, you know, and that's quite difficult.
So given all of this, in your opinion, in general, are two heads better than one?
Yeah. I mean, actually, two heads are better than one. That's for sure, across many, many conditions. The conditions that they have studied where you get two heads are worse than one are the exceptional. I had to dig to find items for which most people are wrong in order to show that two heads can be worse than one. So by and large, two heads are better than one.
Great. Well, Asher Koryat, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Asher Koryat explores the question, are two heads better than one, in a report in this week's Science.
Like livestock, agricultural crops can become infected with tough-to-treat diseases that require quarantines, culling, and sometimes a complete overhaul in farming practices. The latest such plague is citrus greening, an orange tree-destroying bacteria that has already overrun the state of Florida. I spoke with Science News writer Eric Stockstead about the infection's spread into orchards in California and Texas.
Citrus greening is one of the worst diseases that afflicts oranges. It's particularly hard for growers to manage, and the disease has now spread to California and Texas. And scientists are working on a number of ways to try and help combat the disease. The disease was first noticed in China. It's now in many of the major orange-producing regions. It's in Brazil, it is in Central America, it's moving north rapidly in Mexico, it's in Africa, it's in other parts of Asia. Interestingly, it's not been found in the orange-growing regions in the Mediterranean or in Australia, but all of the really the largest orange producers have the disease now.
So what are the effects of citrus greening besides turning the fruit green?
The first thing that happens is the leaves turn yellow and start to get mottled, looking like the plant is stressed. When the tree is really sick, the fruit may drop early. It may stay green and never ripen, and it will be misshapen and can taste sour, which, of course, is an economic loss.
So this story is about how a killer bacteria that infects trees first started in Florida and is now in California. How is this bacteria getting from tree to tree, let alone from all the way from Florida to California?
The disease is caused by a bacterium. That bacterium is spread from one tree to the next by an insect that feeds on leaves and twigs. The insect is called a psyllid, and when it sticks its mouth part into the vascular system of the plant, it will take up a bacterium and then spread it to the next tree that it feeds on. The insect vector was first found in Florida in 1998, and not enough effort was made at the time to control that population. So when they first found an infected tree in 2005, the insects were already spreading the bacterium around, and the disease quite quickly spread across Florida.
How did they get to California?
That's a really good question. Both the insect and the bacterium can be spread when people move infected plants around. So it may be that a nursery plant moved it. It could be that a homeowner took a citrus plant from Florida to California. Both can actually be spread independently. So in California, they first found the psyllid, but not the disease. Mm-hmm. So California in 2008 was already on high alert, and they did pretty intensive insecticide spraying to knock down the psyllid before those psyllids could find an infected tree. Now, just last month, they first found an infected tree in California. The bacterium can also be spread if someone moves just part of a plant to graft it from one tree to another. So someone may take a clipping from a family tree in China where the disease is endemic, or in Mexico, and then graft it onto a tree in a backyard, and then that bacterium is spread through that grafting. Then if the psyllids appear, they can start to spread it from tree to tree.
So if the disease takes root in California, will it have a big impact on everyday citrus consumption, like how much orange juice costs in the grocery store?
It's a slow process. It's been a really bad knock to growers in Florida. It's essentially doubled the cost of growing oranges in Florida. In Florida, most oranges are turned into juice. In California, they're grown for table fruit to eat. So if the disease gets out of control, it really will raise costs and reduce production of fruit. That doesn't happen all at once. In Florida, it's taken a number of years for the disease to get really bad, and it's going to get even worse.
So there are some obvious ways to deal with infested tree, killing the tree, killing the bugs nearby. What else is being done to slow or stop the disease spread?
Well, even those simple things aren't entirely straightforward. One of the really nasty things about this disease is that the tree can be infected before it shows symptoms. So unless you really have good scouts who can identify an infected tree, it may sit there sort of like a typhoid Mary orange tree, silently infecting other trees before you know you really should take it out. That's one of the really complicated things about fighting this disease and why Brazil, for example, they were incredibly aggressive at cutting down trees that even looked sick to try and make sure that they could stop this disease before it got a foothold. So just the simple thing of killing the trees or even battling the psyllids with insecticides is not straightforward. That will work, but you can't do it indefinitely, because if you spray insecticides 12 times a year instead of once a year, that's a really heavy selection pressure for resistance. So there are many other kinds of strategies being worked on that people hope will, A, be able to help a sick tree, which we can't do at all now. Well, not really. Or, better yet, make the trees resistant so they won't catch the disease or they won't transmit it. One of the things that's happening right now is growers are trying to give better nutrition and watering to trees to try and keep them healthy. It's not clear how much of a difference that makes. They're trying it because they don't have much else to try. But that's being studied. Another approach is to give trees antibiotics. Now, this has been shown that it can give at least short-term relief to a tree, and there are some antibiotics that can actually eliminate the bacterium from a tree. But the problem is those are used by humans, so they can't really be approved for agricultural use in orchards. Researchers are trying out many other combinations to see if they can get an antibiotic that ultimately they may be able to inject into the tree. Ultimately, what researchers really want is a tree that is resistant to the disease. And one approach is to try and genetically engineer a tree so it can produce antimicrobial proteins, for example. This is being tried in many labs, and the one that's farthest along is to take two antibacterial proteins from spinach and to splice them into the orange tree so that the orange tree would be able to produce its own antibacterial proteins.
Hmm. So a lot of this stuff sounds like genetic engineering or antibiotics in food, maybe subject to regulation or a long-term research project. What kinds of things can farmers do in the meanwhile to combat this disease?
For growers in Florida or other places where the disease really is endemic, they're trying to basically cope as well as they can, keep the older trees that they have, which are productive and may be infected, as healthy as long as possible before the tree dies and they have to get rid of it. The problem there is you have a lot of disease in the field, so if you plant a young, healthy tree, it's going to get sick sooner rather than later. One idea is that perhaps they can learn to plant lots of young trees very densely, have them well taken care of, and so that they produce fruit sooner than they would otherwise. And you're basically trying to outrun the disease. You know they're going to get sick, but you're trying to get enough fruit off the trees so you can still stay in business before they all die. In California right now and Texas, where the disease was detected in January, they're really in the stage of trying to contain it as much as possible. That's something that Brazil is a good model. They were able to do that with getting the growers organized to spray insecticides all at the same time, aggressive culling of the trees.
All right. Well, Eric, thanks for talking with me.
Nice to be here.
Eric Stockstedt is a news writer for Science. He reports on a potential citrus crisis in this week's issue.
Finally today, I'm here with online news editor David Grimm, who's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site, news.sciencemag.org. So, Dave, first, we have a story on why anesthesia can be so disorienting.
Right, Carrie, for any of us, like myself, who have undergone general anesthesia, you know that when you wake up, you're kind of disoriented, especially if you've been out for a long time. It doesn't actually really seem like very much time has passed. Unlike when you have a good night's sleep, you realize that you've been out for a while. And this new study is all about trying to figure out why that is, why anesthesia sort of mucks with our internal clock. And they didn't test this on people. They actually tested this on honeybees.
Why honeybees?
It's a good question. It turns out that actually humans aren't the only organisms on Earth that respond to anesthesia. In fact, a variety of insects and other animals respond to anesthesia very much like we do. The same concentrations seem to elicit the same effects. And the added advantage of bees is they have very strict daily cycles. If you can think about bees sort of going from flowers to hives and things like that, there are certain times of the day that they do certain things. So it's easy for researchers to figure out if their sort of whole sense of time gets screwed up.
So how did they actually study the effects of anesthesia in these bees?
Well, they looked at a common anesthesia used in humans called isoflurane. And what they did was they basically gave this to the honeybees and they tried to see whether the honeybees would have any sort of disorientation. Now, honeybees use the sun's position in addition to their internal clock. This is something called the circadian clock. We have it too. It regulates our 24-hour cycles. It's the thing that sort of makes us hungry when we wake up in the morning and makes us want to sleep when it gets dark outside. Well, honeybees have the same thing. Honeybees use that clock and they sort of coordinate it with the position of the sun to navigate to and from their hives. And what the researchers found is when they dosed the honeybees with this isoflurane, they were somewhere between 62 and 90 degrees off in trying to find their hives. And not only that, the bees that were trained to visit a feeder between 9 and 10 a.m. every day were off by about 3 hours after they had been given anesthesia. And finally, researchers actually also looked at the genetics of these bees, and they found that the mRNA that plays a role in the circadian clock was actually disrupted, and the cycles that the mRNA undergoes in the cells were off by about 4 to 5 hours after anesthesia.
So there were actually behavioral effects, that they were misreading the sun because they thought it was earlier or later in the day.
Exactly.
But there were also genetic effects on top of that.
Exactly. These bees were really affected on all levels by this anesthesia.
So will this be tested in humans anytime soon?
Well, the idea is that it seems that anesthesia really sort of mucks with our internal clock. One of the things that sets our internal clock is light. And so the researchers say, well, you know, maybe if somebody's under anesthesia, you could sort of shine a bright light on them that would sort of maybe stabilize their circadian rhythms and make them less disoriented after they wake up from surgery, but still to be tested.
Sounds pretty cool. And next up, a potential tool for people suffering from paralysis.
Right. This is another medical type story. It's about people that have paralysis, obviously have trouble or are not able at all to move their limbs. And over the past few years, scientists have developed ways to help people that have especially very severe paralysis to allow them to interact with the outside world. One technique that's been tried is to actually implant electrodes in these people's brains that help them sort of mentally control a cursor on a computer screen or even manipulate a robotic arm. There's other types of prosthetics that sort of use some residual movement. So say you still have maybe a little bit of movement in your shoulder, to use that movement to operate something like a robotic arm or other prosthesis. What this new study is doing is basically trying to combine those two things. It's trying to see, you know, can researchers take the electrical impulses that are happening in the brain and actually use those impulses on the muscles themselves to actually allow somebody who's paralyzed to manipulate an object.
So what sort of technique would be able to do that?
Well, what the researchers did was actually didn't do this on humans. They used a pair of monkeys, and they implanted these electrode grids in the primary motor cortex of the monkey's brains. And this is a region that controls a lot of our body's movement. And the region they focused in on was a region that actually controls the hand. And they had these grids basically listen in on the activity of about 100 neurons in this region. And then the researchers tried to figure out, you know, when the monkeys use their hand, what pattern are these neurons firing in? And they basically decoded the information that these neurons send to the muscles in the monkey's arms. They had also implanted an electrode grid within the muscles of these monkeys' arms. And what they wanted to see is, can we take the information that's coming from the brain, give that information to the grid in the muscles, and cause the muscles to move the way the brain wants them to, even if the monkey's arm is paralyzed. And the way they paralyzed the arms of these animals was they basically just gave them a nerve-blocking drug that prohibited the monkeys from being able to do a specific task. And the task in this case was picking up a rubber ball and dropping it into a tube to earn a reward of juice.
So the first part, when they implanted these electrodes in the brain and the arm, these were in totally functional monkeys before they were paralyzed.
Right.
And they sort of sussed out the electrical signals being sent back and forth.
Right.
But then once they were paralyzed is when they tried to do this task.
Exactly. So when they were paralyzed, at first the monkeys couldn't obviously pick up the ball and drop it into the tube. But when the researchers recreated the signal that the brain would have been sending to the arm, then all of a sudden the monkeys were able to pick up the ball and drop it in the tube as if their arm was functional again, even though it was technically paralyzed.
Wow, that's pretty incredible. So has this been tested in humans?
This hasn't been tested in humans yet, although the researchers say, you know, the same fundamental principle should work just fine in humans. They're thinking about a clinical trial now. These things take a few years, but they really do think that this could offer hope to people that have pretty severe paralysis. Mm-hmm.
And in our third story, we have a totally bizarre methodology for studying migratory birds.
Right. This story, well, let me just cut to the chase. This story has to do with a 2-meter-high pile of bird poop. And this was found by a research technician at a university in Canada. And he wasn't really looking for bird poop. What he was looking for was he was looking for some habitats on his university's campus that may have been used by a bird known as the chimney swift. And the chimney swift is this migratory bird. It flies pretty long distances. But the birds have been really dying out over the past few decades. In fact, about 95% of the population has disappeared between 1968 and 2005. So he was wondering, you know, maybe it has something to do, you know, these guys like to hang out in chimneys. Maybe we've been doing something with our chimneys that have caused the birds to die out, but he wasn't wasn't sure, and he started looking through some chimneys on campus, and that's where he came across this huge pile of bird excrement at the bottom of a 5-story high chimney.
So when life gives you lemons, you make lemonade. And so he said, well, life gives me 2 meters of bird poop, so I...
Right. I don't know if there's a... He didn't make a lemonade with it. But what he did do is he said, you know, I work in this lab that studies sediments in lakes. And what we do in our lab is we can sift through these sediments, and the lower down you go in the sediment, the further back in time that you go. And he said, you know, could we do the same thing with this bird poop? He knew that the bird poop had come from chimney swifts, and it seemed to have been deposited there over decades. So the question was, could we learn something about why these birds started to disappear by sort of digging through the layers of this bird poop?
So I'm curious for how he age-dated this this bird poop, because it was not deposited out in sort of the elements the way that normal, you know, lake sediments are.
Sure, right. It was a great question. And it turns out they use something called radioisotope dating. And this is a complicated story, but basically ever since nations started detonating nuclear bombs around the World War II era, radioisotopes from these nuclear bombs have been deposited in all of our bodies, even up until now. So all of us still have signatures of nuclear bomb testing in our bodies. These signatures have decreased over the decades, and by looking at anything, whether it's a human being or bird poop, you can actually figure out, based on the level of radioisotopes, when somebody was born, and in this case, when this bird poop was deposited. And the researchers figured out that the deposited store stretched from about 1944 to 1992. And 1992 is actually when the chimney was capped, which makes sense because the birds couldn't get in there anymore and they weren't able to deposit their excrement.
Okay, so now they know the time span of when this was all laid down. So what else were they able to find?
So what they did was they actually got in the chimney and they started digging through the bird poop to get, you know, samples from various layers. And what they found is the samples at the very bottom, you know, these were the ones that would be the farthest back in time, had a very high concentration of beetles. And that meant the birds were probably eating a lot of beetles during this time. But as they got higher up in the layer, so in more recent history, there were fewer and fewer beetles and more other types of bugs known as true bugs, which include species like stink bugs and cicadas. And the interesting thing about that is that beetles are actually a lot more nutritious. And these birds, as I said at the beginning, you know, these are long migrating birds. They spend a lot of time in the sky. They need a lot of energy. So the beetles are great food for them. But when they stopped eating beetles and started eating these other bugs, these other bugs were less nutritious and probably contributed to the bird's decline. And the reason beetles started disappearing, the researchers also found different concentrations of pesticides like DDT. There were more concentrations of these pesticides when the beetles started to disappear. And the idea is that pesticides in the environment may have contributed to the decline of beetles, which in turn contributed to the decline of the chimney swift.
Wow. So what else have we had on the news site this week?
Well, Carrie, for Science Now, we've got a story about balancing on tightropes and how mathematicians have found the best way to do it. And also a story about the first gas giants. These are planets like Jupiter that formed in the Milky Way. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about a rash of new spending bills that are sort of making their way through the U.S. Congress and what impact they could have on agencies from NOAA to the National Science Foundation to NASA. And we've also got a story about a new uproar about tobacco research in China. Finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science. This week's Science Live is about human-triggered earthquakes, what impact we're having on the shaking of Mother Nature. And next week's Science Live is about the controversial flu studies that have been in the news for the past few weeks. What is the latest that's going on with them, and how will it impact the publication of controversial scientific research in the future? So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
Great. I will. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Carrie.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out all of our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now and science policy from Science Insider. While you're there, be sure to check out Science Live, a live chat on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the April 20th, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.